So welcome everybody to today's episode of the Independent Teacher Podcast. And this is actually going to be our final episode of season three. So it's a really special episode because I've got with me Dr. Michael Boncher. And Michael is the author of this fantastic book called The Confident Choir. So I'm really pleased, Michael, to have you on today's show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Susan.
Well, yeah, it's certainly something that I've been waiting for, and I've been wanting to talk to you for quite a while. So on this very dull and cold and wet summer's day in the UK, could you start by telling our listeners about your career and also why music has played such an important part in your own life?
That could be a really long story, actually, Susan. So, yes, I was always fascinated by music. And as a kid, you know, I wanted to play every instrument that I saw. I was really lucky because the head teacher at my primary school was very passionate about music. He didn't play anything, but it was one of his main interests. And he made sure that he recruited musicians as form teachers for us. So we were taught to play the recorder. And when we reached a certain standard, we could choose an orchestral instrument, which would be loaned to us indefinitely. So we were really, really lucky. And the poor form teachers then had to spend their breaks and lunch times teaching us how to play those instruments. So when I was asked which instrument I wanted, I chose the trumpet, mainly because it was very shiny and loud. And because I was very tiny, and I'm still very short, actually, the school gave me a cornet first. But then I played the trumpet and the euphonium when I'd grown a bit. I taught myself to play the piano to start with. And I had enough lessons to pass a few exams. But I knew I'd never be a concert pianist because I couldn't stretch as far as an octave until I was in my late teens. So that's where singing came in for me. So for singing, I didn't need to buy an instrument. I already had that. And the instrument I got, fortunately, seemed to be quite a good one, actually. And that was a surprise to me as well as to everybody else. So as an adult, I have a background as a professional singer. I've always enjoyed teaching. When I was a teenager, I found it really hard to decide whether I wanted to be a musician or a psychologist. And for a long time, I took the musical route. So I did a lot of singing and playing and conducting alongside some lecturing in music. And I had a really large teaching practice as well, privately. So I like to call that portfolio working. Some people might say jack of all trades, but I think portfolio lends it an air of respectability. And that variety, you know, it meant that I was never bored. And then in my 30s, you know, I had the chance to revisit my interest in how the mind works. So when I discovered music psychology, and it's not a very well-known subject, so I'm always asked what it is. And also, I'm also asked what possible use could it be. So the sort of brief explanation of music psychology is that it explores all the processes of music teaching and learning, listening and performance. You know, when you've got a toddler, they ask why, don't they? And I've not grown out of that. So asking all the why questions and the how questions. So, you know, why is music so popular? How can music affect our well-being? And why can't my mum sing in tune? And what can we do to stop her? Quite often is one of the favourite questions. So it's a wide-ranging subject area. And nowadays, I'm still what I would call a portfolio worker, but increasingly as a music psychologist and lecturer and researcher, rather than as a performer. So I combine my research in music psychology with some part-time lecturing at several institutions. So I'm the course director for the MA in Music Psychology in Education, Performance and Wellbeing at Sheffield University. I teach on the MA course for musical direction at Leeds Conservatoire. And at UCL in London, I teach on the MA in Music Education. And then I also teach singing for part of the week at a local public school. So that keeps me in touch with local education and gives me a chance to work with people who are smaller than me.
So was it your interest in psychology as well as your interest in music that motivated you to write the book, The Confident Choir? And I wondered as well if you could just give our listeners a brief overview of the book.
Well, I suppose it is related to my research. I suppose that because I've had quite a long practical career as a musician, I used that experience that I've had to inspire my research. So it's often based on a situation that I've come across maybe, or that somebody's talked to me about in my performing life. And I like to do research projects that are useful, you know, that I can take back into either teaching practice or conducting practice. So I did some, I was a singing teacher for a long time. I realized when I was being interviewed for something else recently that it's 40 years since I gave my first singing lesson. So I've always done some teaching singing alongside everything else that I do. And as a conductor of choirs and musical theatre shows, as a teacher of singing and also a piano accompanist for performers, I'd realised that a lot of people get very nervous, or they perhaps don't have a lot of confidence in what they're doing. And when I discovered music psychology, I also discovered that one of the strongest areas of research is into music performance anxiety. So I straight away thought, well, I must look into that. The thing is, I did a research project for my MA, which gave me some quite surprising results, actually. So I did a master's in music psychology. And I found that actually for the amateur singers, you know, really severe performance anxiety, stage fright, is not actually a massive problem. If it is, then often they'll find another way of spending their leisure. Whereas professional performers often need to carry on, even if they're like Adele, you know, who's been known to apparently projectile vomit on the stage. So the main lesson I think from that is not to sit on the front row, you know, if you go and see Adele. But, you know, so people like Adele, of course, they have a performing career, they're getting paid for it. It would be quite difficult to give that up. And there are other examples, and many, many examples. Apparently, Laurence Olivier started having stage fright well into his career. He was very well established when he started experiencing this. There's not necessarily a problem that only happens at the beginning of your career. So, as I say, amateur performers, if they're suffering from terrible stage fright, will probably then become discouraged about performing, which is a shame. So that was an interesting area to me where I thought I might be able to help people. But actually, the more common problem, rather than absolutely disabling stage fright, the amateur singers were more reporting confidence issues that were kind of not as severe, but actually they did still affect their enjoyment of performing as singers. And the confidence issues might also affect how much they got involved in singing. So some singers might decide they were only going to sing in a massive choir where they'd be hidden away, and that they wouldn't be at all comfortable singing in a smaller group. Even if they quite fancied singing in a smaller group, it would put them off. Some people would be happy singing with other people, but get very anxious and nervous about singing a solo. Some people would only join non-auditioned choirs. So there might be a choir down the road that they would like to join, but they won't because they're too terrified about the audition in some cases. So in those sorts of ways, I felt it was a shame that confidence issues were kind of limiting people's participation. And when you think, you know, of all the publicity about how singing is good for us and how singing in choirs and other kinds of group settings is particularly good for our well-being, it's a great pity if some people find that it's spoilt for them by a lack of confidence. So that was kind of my motivation behind it. So when I went on to do my PhD, I decided to kind of look at the more positive topic of confidence rather than performance anxiety, looking at where confidence comes from, how you can nurture it, who affects it, what affects it, and of course how confidence can also be kind of reduced, you know, in certain situations. So the book actually is based on my research. It started out as a guide for leaders of group singing. It's called The Confident Choir, and it covers things like, you know, body language and verbal feedback and some of the less obvious topics, so acoustics, choir configuration, which is all about, you know, the layout of the choir and who's standing or sitting where, who they're sitting standing with. And it also explores how a choir can work, you know, as a community, and looks at the kind of communication that happens between singers as well, and how that affects confidence. And actually, once the book was written, for that reason, I realised that I'd kind of done it a bit of a disservice with the title, actually, because I realised that a lot of what I've written would be helpful to singers as well as to conductors. So I think I should have kind of given it a more inclusive title rather than making it sound it was mainly for the leadership of the groups.
Michael, one of the things that really stood out for me when I read the book was the fact that many of the things that you were writing about in terms of confidence could actually apply to any setting, any career, and particularly any leadership role, any teaching role.
I think that it's worth mentioning, isn't it, that actually, as you say, I mean, teaching in a way is a performance, isn't it? Every time you stand in front of a class and deliver a lesson or a lecture, you're kind of performing. And so, yes, I've done a great deal of work applying my kind of findings and strategies for increasing confidence, not just with singers, but also with conductors, and also with a lot of teachers. I've done a lot of workshops in educational and business settings. And I think the reason for that is that actually people are very afraid of anything that involves public speaking. So number one fear reported in the New York Times was public speaking. And I don't know if you can remember Jerry Seinfeld, but he actually pointed out at the time when he read about this that for most people they feel that they'd be better off in the casket than giving the eulogy, because they're so terrified. So I do get invited to give workshops on giving speeches and making presentations, because these are all essential activities for making progress in so many careers these days. I do a lot of workshops using performance skills for team building and well-being. So those sessions are very popular. And then also some work on using music psychology combined with singing related skills, performance psychology, singing related skills, to help people with vocal problems. So a recent project was working with the NHS using singing related skills to help people with respiratory problems which affect their voices. And then I'm also working on, again, community building in amateur choirs, creating some resources for increasing access and inclusion for minority groups. So my work actually is applicable in all sorts of different situations. That's made my working life really interesting, actually.
I know that sometimes it's very easy to be a teacher in a classroom. That's probably what you're trained to do. And it's probably easier to develop confidence as you go through your career in a classroom with pupils. What many teachers actually find it quite difficult to do is to stand up in front of their colleagues. And that's where some of them would develop, I suppose, stage fright and performance anxiety. Do you have any tips or advice in terms of helping any individuals who need some support in terms of overcoming their anxieties? And that might be whether it's overcoming their anxiety in performing in a choir or just generally overcoming anxiety in any kind of situation.
Yeah, it's a really good point, isn't it, about teachers? Because not, as you say, not only are they in effect performing in front of their students, but they are increasingly required to give presentations for all sorts of occasions. And we also have our academic conferences, don't we, where we're expected to speak. And for job interviews these days, we have to use presentation skills. So the sort of things that I work on with people include working on posture. You know, there is some research that kind of suggests that the way we feel in our bodies actually affects how we feel in our minds, or it affects our emotional state. So you kind of give yourself some almost positive feedback by adjusting your posture so that you look more confident. And it sounds like a cliche, but it can help you to feel as confident. Where the body goes, the mind kind of tends to follow. And there is some good research that supports that. There's a lovely study where the research team asked people, they kind of did a mock interview and they asked people to talk about themselves, but just allowed them to slump like they normally do. In fact, that's what I've been doing so far. I just sat up a bit straighter. But so they asked them questions about themselves while they're kind of just sort of slumping around. And then they ask similar questions, having done some work with them on their posture. What came out of that was that not only did they deliver what they were saying more confidently, but actually they said far more positive things about themselves when they were standing in the confident position than they did when they were slumped. So obviously how they were standing and sitting was affecting how they were thinking as well as how they were feeling. So I always, always start off with working on some posture. I always incorporate that with some kind of collaborative work. So not just standing, but how do we move around the room? How do we come into the classroom? You know, how do we kind of move around in the classroom to give this feeling of confidence? So I get them to do all sorts of kind of mingling exercises. And then I work on breathing, because the thing with singing is the obvious thing that's good for us is that when we're singing, we're slowing down our breathing and really kind of extending our lung capacity, you know. We're also breathing with other people if we're singing in a choir. So that kind of synchronization of breathing and posture within a choir has been shown to increase collaboration and cooperation and sort of sense of belonging and community. So those things get used in my workshops quite a lot as well. One of the things about breathing as well is if you're a singer, is that you're breathing sort of lower down than you would normally. So normally we're kind of moving the chest area, and as singers we're trained to kind of use our tummy muscles a little bit more and to give more space for the lungs to expand at the bottom as well as at the top. So we slow down the breathing, we're getting more air in, and it also affects our heart rate as well. So it's way beyond the surface. It's not just a superficial thing that, oh, we're breathing more deeply, you know. Actually, it affects our heart rate in a way. Again, I don't want to go into great details about it today, but it can affect your heart rate variability in a way that actually helps you to feel more positive and actually does improve performance. Because if you're actually breathing very high up and in a shallow way, I mean, it's very obvious. If you try it now, you know, it immediately tends to start to make you feel a little bit panicky. Whereas if you can just slow that breathing down and try to expand a little bit lower down in the body, which is what we do when we're singing, then it's quite difficult actually not to start to relax. So they're the sort of things that I work on. And I also, depending on what my groups or individuals want, I might do a little bit of work on projecting their voice. And how to not to prepare the material for their lesson or their presentation, but how to deliver it, you know, in an engaging way. Because the other thing that's been found in research is that not only, you know, if we kind of, you know, people talk about smiles, don't they, these days? So smile with your eyes. And so if we're smiling with our eyes, it actually has a sort of feedback response in our own bodies. And can help us to feel a little bit more relaxed and confident. I remember when I was about 5, I was on holiday with my granny, and I went down to the kitchen in the morning and she was singing, you know. And I said, oh, Grandma, you must be happy this morning. She said, no, I was singing to cheer myself up, you know. And so actually, as I think unconsciously, we often do things that kind of give us something positive to focus on. And I think that the breathing certainly is key, really is key to that. So yeah, lots of breathing exercises, lots of combining that with postural work, some movement, general relaxation, some mingling, getting people used to kind of talking to people they've not met before, and presenting themselves in a way that reflects their posture. So it sounds very complicated in a way, I suppose. But actually the concepts are quite simple, really. Sometimes I even, with people who weren't expecting to sing within the workshops, sometimes we do that. I call it singing by stealth. You know, some people would, I think, rather be, do anything other than sing. You know, there are people who think they can't sing and they get very uncertain about it. And I certainly, I'm giving away my secrets now, aren't I? But certainly I quite often have done workshops on well-being, where we don't necessarily say it's going to be singing. We do some postural work with the breathing, the work, movement, and gradually we make sounds and say things and kind of chant things together, and eventually we're singing. And I think that's very healthy. It's good for our well-being. I mean, there's all this publicity about how great it is for us physically and psychologically and socially. But of course, it can be used for team building. And that's why some organisations have started workplace choirs, isn't it? You know, and maybe do some singing together in the morning. So they're all very powerful tools, but not that difficult to learn how to use.
So coming back to joining a choir, I remember when I read the book, there was a very interesting story about a lady who wanted to join a choir, but wasn't particularly good at singing. And in the book, you talk about her experience and you go through the story of how she actually improved and she got better and people supported her on a musical journey. And I thought that was really interesting. So what would you say to anybody who wants to go out and join a choir and thinks that they might not be good enough?
I think one of the main messages that I like to get over to people really is that don't be afraid to shop around a bit. Sometimes, you know, it can be easy to settle for joining the first choir that you visit, or the one that's nearest to you locally, or that your friend goes to, or whatever. But I always think it's worth checking out a few different options. So, and the priorities for me would be, which is what I would be telling any singer, you know, make sure the choir is singing music that you like, that it's being run in a way, you know, that feels comfortable to you. Because again, in a choir, it's not just about the singing. You've got all sorts of social things going on. You've got all sorts of kind of managerial situations and administrative things that go on. Internal politics even can rear its ugly head very, very often. And I think that the most important thing is, yes, make sure that it's being run in a way that feels comfortable to you, and that the choir leader has an approach that you're comfortable with as well. And you know, you were talking about my case study. I think it was the case study of Kate, I think I was calling her, wasn't I, in my book? She came along and didn't know where to sing. She hadn't sung before. She didn't really think she could sing. So the first week that she came to choir, she came and told me that. And I said, well, just join in with whatever you can. Do you think you've got a lower voice or a higher? So she thought she got a lower voice, so she stood with the altos. And I said to her, you know, if that doesn't fit for you, just move, go and sing with some of the other people on the next part. And it was really funny because through the choir practice, she gradually moved through each of the parts that were singing and ended up on totally on the opposite side of the room, having discovered that she got some really great high notes, you know. So I think, you know, I think that don't be afraid to ask if you can do that, you know, to find out where you, what fits your voice. And I think that, and trying several of the different voice parts to see what suits you best. And I think the other thing as well is never, ever do something like singing soprano, for example, just because the choir is short of higher voices. So sing the part that's most comfortable for you. And I'm not suggesting everybody needs to have singing lessons, but I think if you want to find out more about what your voice can do, it is worth trying to find, you know, an empathic singing teacher who can help you with your vocal development. I mean, I've been teaching all those years that I mentioned earlier, and I've met a lot of people who come and say they can't sing. Now, actually, in all that time, I've never taught a person who wants to sing who doesn't actually become able to sing. So I think what I would say is we've all got an instrument. Some of us take a bit more time, or it takes a little bit more effort perhaps to learn how to use that instrument to the best of your ability. But, you know, most of us have got a voice. Most of us can sing in tune. And I do find those people who come along and say that everybody says I'm singing out of tune or whatever, there's always a reason why they're not pitching correctly. And if you can find that reason, then you can help them. They reckon it's between 1-3% of the population have this thing called amusia, which means that they literally can't carry a tune in a bucket. I mean, they can't sing a note at all in tune. But that's a very rare neurological situation. And it's so rare that one of my colleagues was actually doing some serious sort of lab work and research on basically tone deafness, amusia. And she found it very difficult to recruit enough people to do the study because it's so rare.
Now, I know your book is full of very inspirational quotes, but I wondered if you could just take our listeners through this this lovely quote that comes towards the end of your book, and I'll just read it out to you. A leader is best when people barely know he exists. When his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will say, we did it ourselves.
My research has kind of taught me that, well, it's taught me a valuable lesson, actually, that it really isn't all about the conductor. So when I asked singers who took part in my research about the people who have the greatest effect on their confidence, either positively or negatively, I asked an open question like, can you tell me about some of the people who affected your confidence as a singer? And I assumed, probably because I've got a massive ego, I guess, I assumed the first person they'd mention would be the conductor, obviously. But actually, in every case, whether it was in focus groups or individual interviews, the first people my research participants mentioned were the other people that they were singing with, and the verbal and non-verbal communication between the singers was very influential, had a massive effect on their confidence. So I started looking at those group dynamics and community building in a lot more detail. The conductor obviously was mentioned, though, because I'm not trying to say conductors aren't important. There's an absolutely vital role there. But they were mentioned things like the sort of things that conductors often worry about, you know, like, what are my gestures looking like? Am I a good conductor? Am I a good enough musician to be conducting this group? All those sorts of things. They didn't come into it at all. Singers very rarely mentioned musicianship or gesture or anything like that, apart from kind of the general point that if you've got a conductor who's conducting well and has good musical knowledge, you have faith in them and faith in their opinion. On the other hand, though, what the singers were talking about far more in terms of what affects their confidence was things like the conductor's body language and what the conductor says to the choir, how they say it, you know, and whether or not they create a collaborative environment. So I think sometimes the singers don't necessarily realise what the conductor's contributing. Conductors equally don't necessarily recognise how much the singers are contributing. Because, you know, every choir's got its own culture, hasn't it, an ethos, and we're all part of that. So I suppose, yeah, it's about building an effective team. And for me, it helps me as a conductor, and partly for my own confidence, actually, as well, to see myself as part of that team rather than somebody who's just standing out at the front alone, you know, responsible for everything.
Right. What I want to do now is just change the focus of our conversation as we come to the end of the show. And I wanted to talk about something completely different. And this is based on some of the articles that you've written in the academic journal called The Conversation. And one of those articles talked about how it was really, really difficult for well-known artists, musicians, to actually retire. And I could give as an example Elton John, Vicky Leandros, German singer. So why do these performers in their 70s just struggle to retire? Because both of those two individuals have said almost exactly the same thing. You know, we're retiring, we're on our final tour, but we might come back. You know, we might still perform a little at a later date.
It's quite complex. I think the key to that is related to some of the points about performance anxiety, because if you think about it, there are a lot of people who have actually been very open about their own performance anxiety, but they still continue to perform professionally and perform well. And firstly, performance anxiety or lack of confidence does not reflect on your ability. Some of the best performers in the world have said, I mean, Ozzy Osbourne's one who's mentioned it, isn't he? Barbara Streisand disappeared for 27 years because she was very worried because she'd forgotten her words in a concert and didn't do a live performance for all of that time. So people obviously are getting something out of it that means that they want to overcome that performance anxiety or perform despite that. And I don't think it's about, I don't think it's all about the money or the adulation. I really don't. I think it's about what music does in some ways for us. So music's one of the ways that people can experience flow or being in the zone, so that they become immersed then in the performance or in the activity that they're doing. They forget about everyday concerns. There can be a loss of self-consciousness. You know, if you're actually absorbed in the music that you're performing, that in itself can counteract some of the anxious feelings because you're getting taken over by the music. You're getting into a flow state. And of course, that can in a way be quite addictive, quite difficult to give up. And I think also for a lot of performers, you know, making music is really inherently pleasurable. And their musical achievements have a significant effect on their self-esteem. So, you know, when we're talking, when musicians are talking to each other, and, you know, you realize that performers often define themselves by this, their sense of identity as a musician. They might define themselves in terms of their ability or their popularity as a musician. And of course, it can be quite difficult to give up, because the question then becomes, if you've devoted your life to being a performing musician, if I'm not performing, who am I now? That's quite a scary thought, I think, for some people. So I think there's that. I think obviously for those of us who are not rich and famous like Elton, you know, continuing to work can be financially motivated as well as being a big part of our life in other ways. So I think sort of musicians who are perhaps not in that level, but there's still, I mean, there are many very gifted and able and captivating musicians who are not working at the same level as, say, Elton or Barbara Streisand, but they're still having a really impressive performing career, but they might be not so financially rewarded, and in that case, obviously, carrying on may well be because, as musicians, we don't always have massive pensions and things, you know. So, however, I mean, I used to get a bit worried about that when I was younger. You know, I was constantly worried that my retirement plan was to carry on teaching until a nanosecond before my last breath. And I was a bit depressed about that. But actually, now I'm older, I realise, you know, I'm very lucky to be able to keep working in such interesting ways. And I sort of think, well, you know, if I'm feeling that, no doubt lots of these, you know, world famous performers must be feeling a little bit the same, really.
I mean, I personally was quite relieved. I didn't feel that I wanted to carry on in my role as a teacher. But I do something else, like this podcast and writing books. I think it's about finding a sense of purpose, isn't it? One career ends, but then the next stage of your life begins. And so perhaps for some people, you know, joining a choir is really important when they're looking for something else to do as a really positive outlet. And it's good for the brain, isn't it? Keeping active.
It could be, Susan. And, you know, I've had so many people joining choirs when they're in their 60s or 70s who've literally said, I sang when I was a kid and I've not sung for like 50 years. So I thought I'd come in and see if I could sing in a choir. And, you know, and they absolutely flourish doing it. And the same in private lessons. I've had so many adults, again, later in life who are coming and they'll say things like, oh, I think I've left it too late to play the piano. Don't you have to start by the time you're four or something? Well, yes, maybe if you want to be a world famous person like Lang Lang or something, you know, you do have to start early and put all that work in and all those hours. But, you know, you can still become a really good musician and get a lot out of it, even if you're starting, you know, after retirement. And so I've had a lot of students who've really enjoyed doing that.
Now, as we come to the end of our conversation, I do want to come back to your book. And I wanted to talk about this poem that you reference called Our Deepest Fear. Could you tell us about the poem and then also the effect that it's had on you?
Yeah, is a poem that's was written by Marianne Williamson, who wrote a book called A Return to Love. And it's had a huge effect on me. Do you mind, Susan, if I read the first little section? So the poem starts like this. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? And that had an immediate impact on me as soon as I read it for the first time. It was actually, I was going for some physiotherapy for a little injury that I'd sustained while I was performing, actually, and which meant that I wasn't able to sing for a little while. And it was on the wall at my physio's clinic. And yeah, it had an immediate impact. I grew up in a very complex family situation where musical ability and academic achievement were not valued. That's an understatement. Although I achieved a lot despite that, as an adult, I've realised that earlier in my life, I spent a lot of time hiding my light or my lights under a bushel because it felt safer, you know, to do that than to draw attention to myself. So one of my underlying fears was that if I became exceptional in some way, you know, it would attract unwelcome attention. So I lived really quietly and developed a kind of self-deprecating sense of humour, you know, to get over that. And reading the poem made me realise that this way of behaving, of kind of trying not to attract attention to yourself and hiding the things you're good at, is not the best, and that, you know, we should allow ourselves to acknowledge and celebrate our achievements. It's taken me a long time, but over the past few years I've started allowing myself to take pride in what I've done and what I'm still doing, and doing this podcast actually, Susan, has helped me enormously because it's encouraged me to reflect on that musical and educational journey that I've been on. Can I read you another section? So this section of the poem has inspired me by celebrating the fact that we're all different. It's really sweet. A tulip doesn't strive to impress anyone. It doesn't struggle to be different than a rose. It doesn't have to. It is different. And there's room in the garden for every flower. And that really spoke to me because in my teaching, it's, again, it might sound kind of simplistic, but my number one priority is to recognise that everyone is different. Everyone learns differently. They have different reasons for wanting to learn something. And they do have different priorities, you know, and goals. The person-centred approach to me is very important in my own teaching. And there's one other little section, if you don't mind, Susan, because I am obsessed with this poem. I think it's brilliant. So the final section is really inspiring, and I won't read it to you, but it does very, very poetically make the point that, you know, as we're all so different, it's absolutely pointless to compare yourself with other people, you know. And that's a mistake, I think, that often singers can make, you know. And generally, we do, don't we? It's easy to look at everybody and kind of think, well, they're happier, more beautiful, wealthier, cleverer, more important than me, because we see people only presenting their best selves on social media. And I think for singers, it's very easy for people to get despondent. You know, if they're thinking, well, I can't sing as high as she can. Well, maybe you can't sing as high as she can, but singing high isn't everything. You might be a fantastic alto, you know, and your tone is beautiful. So yeah, comparing ourselves with other people isn't what matters. It takes our focus away from who we are, you know, and finding the music that fits us and means something to us.
Oh, thanks, Michael, and thanks for sharing that poem. It's so beautiful. I can't think of a better way to end season 3. It's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks. It's been a real pleasure, Susan. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Independent Teacher Podcast. If you like listening to this podcast, please consider giving us a 5-star rating either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.